Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
With early detection comes early prevention.
Put lead in your pencil, make you feel like a champion.
Rise up again, let nothing keep you down. To live your best,
hear the urologist speak.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Think you're losing grip of your manhood, don't give up on hope.
Don't be ashamed, it's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. I have two special guests in the house that mean a lot to me. I'll get into that in a moment, but just a few quotes, just giving a hint of what we're going to talk about today. Work hard in silence. Let your success be your noise. Not everyone wishes for you to succeed. What they cannot see, they cannot derail. So firstly, I have my younger sister, who is very accomplished in her own right, a Bahamian, born and grown, who has had great success in Boston, Massachusetts. And her husband, who is my brother-in-law, of course, but actually I would say is just as much a brother as anything else, because he's been with my sister over 30 years since she was in high school, so he's always been a part of my family and my brother in the truest sense. Again, accomplished beyond words, also born and bred, St. Augustine's College graduate, and they're here trying to provide some positivity. We've spoken many, many times, particularly in the last few weeks, about the emphasis on the negative in the media, on the radio, in the newspaper, on the television. And we're not talking enough about this present generation doing remarkable things throughout the world, not just in our country, but throughout the world. So these two individuals, I think, are going to provide a great amount of strength and encouragement to a lot of young persons that the sky is truly the limit. They're is no ceiling. You can accomplish anything in life. Even coming from a small 21-by-7-mile island, there's nothing that you cannot do. So I'd like to welcome my sister, Giselle Joffer. Welcome, Giselle.
Well, good evening, Bahamas, and thank you for having me, Greg.
And my brother-in-law, Dr. Elon Joffer. So just going along the long length of and breadth of their accomplishments, and they're very humble persons, but I'm just mentioning them because I want them to be an inspiration, particularly for young persons. And it starts at the very top. He graduated from St. Augustine's. He went to St. Anselm's College, which is just out north of Boston, actually in New Hampshire. He went to Tufts University for dental school. He's a dentist and orthodontist. Tufts University is the top number one dental school in the United States. He then went on to Harvard, where he went to hospital and dental school, hospital-based dental school at Harvard Medical School. He then went on to go back to Tufts University, again, the top dental school in the United States, and do orthodontist, which is a subspecialty within dentistry, which is the most difficult specialty within dentistry. He then went on and did a fellowship in public health and healthcare management at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health. He then went on and became a faculty member of the Harvard Dental School. He is an immediate past president of the Massachusetts Association of Orthodontists, very impressive in itself. He's also one of the top Invisalign braces providers in the world. ranked in the top 1% in the world, not in just Massachusetts or in the United States, but in the world. And he's a lecturer for Invisalign within the United States and worldwide, Europe, Asia, and throughout. Now we'll start with my sister Giselle, who's my younger sister, but I've always looked up to her for her fortitude and her strength and her great academic prowess and her dedication to everything she puts her mind to. She was actually many years at government high school, so we are always, a lot of persons will knock the government high school system, but she actually chose to go from private school to the public school. I think she said there were private school students were a little bit too stuffy for her, but she was able to thrive in the public health high school, and then she went on to St. Andrews, where she graduated having received a scholarship at St. Andrews. She went on to Harvard and did economics, where she graduated magna cum laude. She then went to Yale Law School, which is the number one law school to this day in the United States, the most difficult law school to get into. So we have, my sister got into the most difficult law school in the United States. My brother-in-law got into the most difficult and number one rated dental school in the United States in the form of Tufts University. So at Yale Law School, she excelled. She then went on to become a partner at a major law firm. She then went on to become a U.S. assistant attorney. I know we're Bahamians, but that is a very big deal. To become a U.S. assistant attorney, particularly someone of color, particularly a woman of color, that is almost unheard of. So she's always been a trailblazer and a tower of strength. She then went on to become an equity partner, and equity means that you actually have a stake in the partnership. So she's a big timer in a law firm in Boston, and it's ranked in the top 25 of all law firms in the United States. So again, a glowing achievement. She was also a council member of the Boston Bar Association. She received a few years ago a Trailblazer Award for the Black Lawyers Association. And I do remember when you were in law school, you were also the president of the Black Law Association, was that, or something like that?
I think you're thinking of when I was in college.
Oh, sorry.
I was the president of the Association of Black Harvard Women.
Okay, all right. Yes, and the list goes on and on, but I think we've gotten the picture. They are remarkable individuals. So let's start with you, Ilan Jaffer.
Well, first of all...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, good evening, Bahamas, and thanks, Greg, for having us. We're very proud of you and your contributions, you know, not just in the medical field, but here at large in terms of trying to contribute to, you know, our nation and building it and the next generation. So we want to congratulate you on all of your hard efforts and your successes. And we are very appreciative and grateful that you have us here to share it with you. And so thanks for having us.
Well, my first quote is work hard in silence and let your success be your noise. So I'm trying to stay below the radar, but I thank you. I thank you for those words. This is a country of haters, unfortunately, and you are in the great old Boston, Massachusetts. No one can touch you.
Oh, I don't know.
They can touch me. Although I don't think I have any more space in the back. All the knives that are still in it. But I have to sleep on my stomach. But that just made me stronger. So you came from what we would describe as humble beginnings. You've come from what would be considered a rough area that has a lot of crime, a lot of delinquency, not a lot of good comes out of McCullough Corner. Where exactly is McCullough Corner? Because not everybody knows.
Well, I think a lot of good comes out of McCullough Corner, but I think, you know, as you said, I think...
Well, there's a lot of negative connotations.
Yes, I think the perception with the area is one that, you know, I think a lot of folks, some for good reasons and some, you know, but that's neither here nor there. But I just wanted to say I think it's a great place. I was born and raised there, and obviously it's home for me. It's near and dear. But you asked specifically where it is. It's, you know, between East Street and Collins Avenue. I think a lot of folks would recognize it as, you know, as a shortcut, if you will, heading from East Street into, you know, the Centerville area. It's just one of those side corners that you would take as you're heading east on the island, and it can be whether you're coming from Bay Street or if you're heading from the south. So that's it's in the.
I think most people know, but
yeah.
I mean, when people think, okay, a young boy, a young teenager, McCullough Corner, could you ever imagine that you would be a Harvard Dental School lecturer, that you would go to Tufts University, that you'd go to Harvard Medical School, that you would receive all these accolades and achieve such greatness?
No, not at all. That wasn't even a goal. You know, quite frankly, I think, it's one of those things that happened. I'm very grateful to God and for the opportunities and the path that my life has taken. But, you know, do I think it can happen for others? And do I think it's possible? Yes. Was that a goal? No. Having had the opportunities and the resources that I was exposed to and the communities that I was involved with, starting right from McCullough Corner, you know, I'm not surprised that it happened, right? I've always been surrounded by loving folks, came from a loving community, a supportive community, wonderful parents, wonderful family. And so the sauces, the ingredients, the secrets to success were present, but I don't think I had like a specific goal as to what I would define success or what I had envisioned for myself with regards to specific accolades or accomplishments. You know, I left the Bahamas at 18 with a clear one goal, and the only goal I had was I wanted to become an orthodontist. I didn't have any idea or specifics with regards to what schools I would go to, how that would happen. I just knew I wanted to become an orthodontist. And the only thing that I was crystal clear about was that it was going to take a lot of schooling. And so from the outset, I had this commitment to education and knowing that, okay, I'm going to have to really stick with this. You know, there were going to be 4 years of undergraduate. It's going to be another 4 years for dental school, another three, possibly four, depending on which path you took to specialize, and then even more so depending on other interests. And so that commitment was there, but I didn't have a specific, you know, pathway or a specific goal or a specific outline that I had. I just knew this is what it's going to take, and I'm committed to it.
And you did have a role model in the form of Dr. Barry Russell, is that correct?
100%. I have to give Dr. Russell his props and the team over at Bahamas Orthodontic Center. That's where I started out. You know, he just returned home as the first Bahamian orthodontist. And I got an opportunity to work in his practice for a summer job at the age of 14. And that planted a seed for me that basically sprouted into this vision and this goal of wanting to become an orthodontist, just because I saw all of the positives of the profession and the wonderful impact that you could have on individuals, particularly, you know, when you're as an orthodontist, you treat the full range, right? From 70 to 80 is what I like to say, and anywhere in between. There aren't any age limits, but on average, you know, the patient population ranges from 7 to, you know, say 80. But a large portion are, you know, tweens and adolescents. And what was always fascinating to me was the ability and the opportunity to have an impact on young individuals, and not just on their self-worth and on their self-esteem through improving their smiles, but also just through mentoring and mentorship and just speaking positivity into them. And so that was always fascinating to me. It still is. It's one of my favorite aspects of being an orthodontist. But yeah, that's, you know.
And I'm sure when you come home, you're heralded as a hero in McCullough Corner.
I don't think so. No, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I think I'm just good old Elon from McCullough Corner, and I would prefer for it to be that way. I'm not referred to as anything other than Elon. No titles or anything like that.
Okay, let's bring Giselle into the part of this conversation.
Sure.
We'll have to also mention my younger brother and your younger brother, Jonathan, who also is very accomplished. He is a gastroenterologist in New Jersey, in the United States. He went to a top university in the form of Columbia medical school where he did his internship and then went on and did subspecialty and fellowship in gastroenterology and Columbia
and
University.
To Lehigh before that.
Yeah, and Lehigh. And he also, Columbia University is, I think, was ranked 7th in the world in medical schools. So, Giselle, I know, I don't know, your success, I know you as an avid reader. I know that that where you found your love for academics was reading. You read everything and anything that you could get your hands on. We also need to mention that just as Elon's parents made endless sacrifices, we had parents who also made endless sacrifices. We had grandparents who made endless sacrifices as well. We have a maternal grandfather who never went past grade one. We have a maternal grandmother who never finished primary school. So from the humblest of beginnings, I'm sure they're smiling down on you from heaven. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about your path from high school, what your goals were, what were your inspirations, and what was life like in the great Harvard University? Everybody dreams of going to Harvard University, and both of you have become a part of Harvard folklore.
So much to unpack there.
Yes.
So much to unpack. First, I'd like to just say it's a pleasure to be here with my big brother, Greg, and he is a urologist. I think I like to think about themes and patterns. Elon knows this. And yes. For me, one of the themes I hope coming out of this, hour plus will be dream big and also not to put limits on yourself. And while Gregory knows me as a reader, I actually know Gregory as a creative, despite the fact that he's a urologist. So he grew up building Legos, drawing cartoons, doing comedy. He loves film. And so I see you at home in this space and having your show. And I'm proud that you've been able to find a creative space in addition to your service as a medical doctor. You then talked about education a little bit and the fact that we had a grandfather who was a patriarch of the Davis family who really provided the opportunity for a lot of us to have education, starting with our mom's generation and going off to college and having not had that opportunity himself. And so while education is an accolade and you went to this school, you did this, you did that, education is also an opportunity that I think we feel very blessed for. And, thank you to God, and also thank you to the ancestors and everyone else who provided this pathway for us in going forward.
And I'd also like to, I don't want to be remiss in mentioning, we have paternal grandmother and grandfather who sacrificed tremendously. They moved in 1964 from Sri Lanka. At that time it was Ceylon, that was in the middle of a civil war, to move to Toronto, Canada, where they knew nobody, in the freezing cold, because they wanted to have their children and then their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren have a better life and more opportunity. So I would like to thank them for that endless sacrifice. And our parents are both educators. Our mother was a primary school teacher, then went on to become a guidance counselor. Our father is better known than even myself.
Absolutely.
We've been teaching in this country for 50 years. I can't go a day without someone saying, Dr. Pinto, your father, Alan Pinto, is a great man, every single day. So that inspires me. My mother was the one who sat with us and made sure that we did our homework and strived for greatness in all of us, as did our father. Obviously, we didn't have a silver spoon in our mouth, being a teacher and a guidance counselor's children. But we didn't want for anything.
Absolutely.
And just as Elon's parents were blue-collar workers, Elon never had to want for anything either, but they were able to instill...
They instilled some great qualities.
Great qualities.
Wonderful.
Work. Sometimes, and I've seen it, even with my friends, my colleagues... Sometimes when you have too much too early, it actually leads to the negative. You could actually not have that inner drive
Yes.
That, yeah, or that hunger. Yeah,
that hunger, yes. The hunger that a lot of people who didn't have everything all at once or nothing came easy. I would say some of my greatest success in coming here is the trials and tribulations, mm-hmm. the hate, the walls that I kept hitting against that made me stronger than I ever thought possible. And just, it could either break me and I could just put my tail behind my legs and leave the Bahamas, or I can just push that wall down and don't worry about the haters and the detractors and everything else and keep my eye on the prize and the light, and that's to make this country a better place on whatever level I can. And to one personal goal, at least 120 men die of prostate cancer every year. Mm-hmm. In my career, I'd like to cut that down to almost 20, in whatever way possible that is, I'm going to do it. There are always going to be naysayers, but you just got to push forward.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important point that you bring up. It's about growth, right? Mm-hmm. Growth comes through adversity.
That's right.
And so we're going to hit hard times. We're going to have failures. Some will be public, some will be private. You're going to have some difficult moments. There will be moments where you're going to feel like there's imposter syndrome or you're doubting yourself or your ability to accomplish whatever it is that you're trying to. But don't be deterred by those setbacks. It's because in those moments of what some would describe as failure or you know, setbacks, that's where the real growth comes, right? That's where the real determination and character is built. Because it's easy to chase something or go after something when everything's falling in line. But it takes a person of real strength and real character to dig deep when things aren't going the way you expect it to. And when folks are telling you that the goal that you're trying to achieve is not achievable, or it's not best suited for you, or you're not an individual who's built for that. Right?
Oh, like I was told that.
People come with all of their stories and their reasons as to how your story should be written. But remember, it's your story.
Yeah,
you can't exactly let folks project onto you their story or their fears or their inhibitions. And oftentimes that's what happens. But going back to, you know, that adversity piece, you just really, if there's one thing I can challenge, I want to encourage folks to do is to embrace adversities and challenges as growth opportunities, right? Don't look at them as situations where you're going to be, you know, terminated from your goal or terminated from the path that you're trying to take to get to where you want to be. Just embrace those moments, dig deep, do a lot of self-reflection, and figure out a way to move beyond that and to become a better person. I mean, that's what growth is about, right? It's about taking what's in front of you, utilizing it, and instead of it being an obstacle, taking it as an opportunity.
Well, I'll say that I can write a PhD in what you just said. I faced the obstacle. I was told, don't even do surgery, or don't go to this place, or you'll never succeed. What's the point of going there? So I went to Cape Town, South Africa, Groote Schuur Hospital, which I'm very proud to say was named one of the top 25 hospitals in the world. It was also named top 3 in the world for teaching and research, a remarkable accomplishment. So there are always going to be a lot of naysayers. I remember finishing, and I came top 2 in the country for urology when I did exams. Again, a feat never seen by anyone who was a foreigner, because in certain sectors, particularly in urology, that discipline, I think many of the senior persons and professors didn't realize apartheid was over. Mm-hmm. So essentially, when it came to final consultant exams, if you were white and South African, you pass until you've proven otherwise. If you were non-white and particularly a foreigner, you failed until proven otherwise. So you literally had to work 10 times harder. You had to be 10 times better. You could have said the same thing in an oral exam and you would have gotten a lower mark than mm-hmm. your white mm-hmm. counterpart as well. So in fact, the only reason I came second is because there was a white South African woman who was repeating the exam and got the prize for the top mark, although she was repeating the exam, which was stipulated she's not couldn't have gotten the top mark because she was repeating. But I just let it go. I was happy to get my exam and get out and do great things. I went on to Germany, went on to India, I went on to France, and I work with some of the best in the world in subspecialties within urology. And I did all that and sacrifice, and I had the support of my wife, who inspired me to do great things, inspired me to be better than I ever thought I could ever be. And right. I've said that many times, the wrong wife can ruin you, the right woman can make you a tower of strength and make you sky go above the clouds and into the stars. And that's exactly what I have. So I have nothing without my wife, who was with me when I had nothing, when I was studying till 5 a.m. and going on 2 hours sleep. She was there with me making coffee for me when I didn't have a dollar to rub.
Oh yeah,
or 2 cents to rub to. So
it's facts.
There's always a journey, and a lot of people say, "Oh, look at Dr. Ilan Jaffer. He has 2 offices. He's successful. He's a Harvard lecturer. He went to Tufts and this." They don't know the hell that you went through. They don't know what Giselle went through, going through Harvard and Yale, going through the freezing cold, going through the racism on so many levels, but it just makes you stronger.
Yeah. Yes. I, when you speak, you know, I think of, I always say there's the process and then there's the outcome, right? And so what you're saying, when people look at, not just us, right, but anyone who they deem successful, they're often looking at the outcome. But sometimes, and frequently hidden, it's basically the process, right? What they had to go through to get there. I always say, if you think of any elite athlete, folks always see them in the championship or at the, you know, at the pinnacle. But they don't see, you know, waking up pre-dawn to do the workouts. They don't see the continuous setbacks and practices, the relentless training, right? It's the work that you, it's the process of the work going in to get to that particular outcome. And also to piggyback on what you said about, you know, the importance of choosing the right spouse or the right partner in life, as I like to qualify it. We have 2 daughters and we preach this to them all the time. Probably the single most, one of the single most important decisions you're going to make in your life is going to be the person you choose to partner with. And I believe that wholeheartedly. I don't think it is the most, but it is one of the more important decisions.
Well, I might be biased in saying this, but I think you're great because of Giselle.
You know, I don't think you're biased. I endorse that.
It's mutual.
Yes, yes. You know, so when I remember we got married and someone said to me, "Oh, you're getting one of the," what did they say? They said, I'd like to tell the story, because they said, it was someone from your family who said, "Oh, you're getting one of our best," or something like that. And I said, "Well, I think she hit the jackpot." You know, and the lady said, "Oh, you're feisty." I'm like, "Well, you know, iron sharpens iron." So I agree. You know, Giselle's been a strong support for me over the years and been by my side throughout many a challenges. And I'd like to think that I do the same, and we support each other and help each other become better of ourselves.
And then as you say that, there isn't enough of that in our society, not that strong nuclear family, not two strong professionals working together. And a lot of successes in this country, it's lost from one generation to the next. We look at a lot of, we'll talk about it even just on racial terms, a lot of Black Americans who are successful, the next generation are not. It's not so much in terms of statistics for white Americans or Asian Americans. Why do you think that our country is falling down in terms of a lack of a strong nuclear family? It's a loaded question, but...
Well, you know, here's the thing. I can't speak to that. I'm not an expert on that area, so I'm not even going to try to break that down or build it back up, because I just don't know the nuances. What I will say I know about our country, and what I do know about us as individuals, we're a loving group of folks, right? And we're a very resilient group of folks. And we're a strong community, right? And so part of what allowed me to succeed in the ways that I felt that I've been successful is growing up here in the Bahamas and coming from the community that I came from in McCullough Corner and having the family that I have with my immediate family, my extended family. You know, I can think of all my aunts, my uncles, both maternal and paternal, cousins, relatives. So just thinking of the community at large here, right? And I think there is still this strong sense of community here. And having lived here in the Bahamas and living in the U.S., I can say, not that there isn't a sense of community there, but I felt a deeper sense of connection here and a deeper sense of community. And I still do. And, you know, I return frequently and our daughters come with us frequently. And I think they feel the same. And so the point I'm trying to make is I won't sit here and pontificate about who or why or what's going on with the nuclear family as it exists. But I will say that from what I can see, I'm very happy and hopeful because I see a strong community. I see a people who are just really hard workers. And more importantly, I see folks who are just helping each other, right? And it may not be obvious all the time, and it may not be in the traditional sense or the traditional way that we expect to see it, but, you know, from my experience, it's been a little different than what you just described. So, but that's just my personal take.
Okay. Well, Giselle, let's talk about coming from a small town island girl, 21 by 7 mile mm-hmm. island, going to Harvard. What was life like? And I remember an interesting fact. Wasn't Tatiana Ali, the actress from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, in your dorm in Harvard?
She was. Okay. She was in my dorm at Harvard. And that's just sort of a piece of everything that was kind of astonishing and bigger than life for me when I had the opportunity to go to Harvard University. I think what was a natural fit for me was that I, as you mentioned, I love to read and I just loved education. And I loved being a student. And so for anyone who's out there who just loves words, who loves books, who loves studying, who loves learning, who's curious about the world, just stay on that path and keep going, regardless if you see blocks, whether they be financial blocks or I never even thought about applying to an Ivy League school, except for I have to give thanks to the Life for Key Foundation. That gave me a binder of colleges in the U.S. that would give money to international students. And I went through that binder, and I think I probably applied to 15 schools. And I was like, I might as well throw this Ivy League school into the mix. Never in my wildest dreams thinking that I would go. And I went, and I was so intimidated. And I figured, well, what I know how to do is study.
That is true.
And so I studied, and I took advantage of many opportunities there. And for those who are considering or dreaming of an Ivy League education, I think the most that you get from it actually is your peers and the community. Elon mentioned community, the community that you're surrounded by. And still some of the women, and in particular Black women I went to college with, remain my best friends. They remain my mentors. They're the people who I call. I feel like I have therapists, consultants, business experts, you know, entrepreneurs on call just from the like the best in the world, just from the community of people I schooled with as a teenager. So it was a lot of fun for me.
Well, I remember more than just Excel, because I remember you, even was it the first year or second year, you became a teaching assistant, which is a great honor. That means you're the best of the best.
Well, Greg, this is my brother, so he's a little biased, but
is it a correct statement?
Yes.
Okay.
But
I'll second that statement, Greg.
Yeah. I think like I had my nose in my books for sure, and there were a lot of opportunities that came from that and a lot of doors opened. But I think the important thing for those who are listening to take away is that it wasn't a master plan. It was sort of just a step by step of organically doing the best I could in any moment. And Elon talked about adversity, and there were definitely moments, both in Harvard undergrad and in Yale's law school, where I was just like, where am I going to get the strength to go on, right? Like, I feel like a fish out of water, either because I didn't understand the complete cultural history or context that I was studying in, having come from the Bahamas to the United States, or the fact that I was not connected to my immediate community. My family was way back in the Bahamas, and I'm going to age myself, but like, you know, I didn't have like WhatsApp and all this stuff. I was spending like $1 million a minute to call Elon to get a fresh word. And Gregory was in Jamaica studying. I spoke to him probably like every 4 months. So there were definitely some hard times. And I think you just have to find, I have a friend actually from Harvard who said, when you feel empty, And there's like, you just don't know where you're going to get that next bit of strength. And you just have to like go to sort of go to the well to kind of like dig for that next piece of water. What is it that will bring you to that moment? And I've found strength in various things over the years. You'll find your own strength. Certainly some part of my strength is from my family and from the family that I've created with Elon and also through my faith and gospel music. I love to listen to a good gospel song when I'm down. But I think in all of these opportunities, there will be struggle on your way to find success.
And I'd like to give a shout out to LQ. I'm not going to say her name. She knows who she is. But that's Giselle's friend who she referenced. And the statement was accurate that she said, you know, when you have nowhere else to go, the well is dry. Where can you dig to go? And she was very clear and emphatic in mentioning that it was her faith, yes, her relationship with God. And I think, you know, all three of us here can attest to that. But I want to call it out, mm-hmm, right, and be a little bit more specific about it. Because there will be moments where you may speak to a friend, you may speak to a family member, and you're just not getting the fuel that you need to get through that moment. And that's when you have to rely on your faith. And that's when you have to rely on your relationship with God. And for me, like, that's important, right? And that's not just something I'm saying. It's something that I live. And it's because I know the source. We know the source. You know, we have these resources and each other and all these things and all of these, other aspects of life that folks provide for us. But there is only one source. And so I want to really give a shout out to LQ for, mm-hmm, for always reminding us of that. And of course, you know, going back to your comment earlier, Greg, about, you know, the family structure in the Bahamas or the unit here. And I will say that my faith community here was also a big part of my success. You know, I have an older sister who, you know, I went to Temple Christian for my primary school. And I think that was a solid foundation for me in terms of giving me the rock, right, from which it was hard to move me from and shake me. Like, it was a real firm foundation. And I've just continued to pour into that and lean into that and try to build that and just utilize it day in and day out and pass it on to our girls and just to anyone. You know, I talked earlier about trying to be a mentor to younger patients and younger individuals, and that's a big part of what we talk about, right? Not hitting people over the head with it or not trying to even just be so overt with it, but just letting people know that you have what it takes within you. You can do it. You just have to find the right button to push or the right knob to turn to activate it, right? And for many different folks, those buttons or knobs are different things, but just trying to encourage individuals to identify what it is so that they can activate their own success, whatever that may be.
And you never know what path God has for you. Sometimes the greatest hell can put you out on the right path. I'll use a personal story where I went to Cape Town, South Africa, to the world famous Curtis Keir Hospital, where they did the world's first heart transplant in 1967. And I was trying to get into urology. I was in general surgery at the time. I never wanted to be a general surgeon. So there were only 6 spots for urology for a 5-year program. And 5 of those spots were guaranteed for South Africans. There was 1 foreign spot. And to get that foreign spot, you had to wait for that one person who was there to graduate. It happened that someone had just started a year before I got there, and essentially for me even have a chance of getting that one spot, I'd have to wait another 4 years. And I would say I was there toiling along, doing my best, thinking of other subspecialties. Urology was always my goal in life, but thinking of going to other countries, etc. But the individual who had the spot, he was from Russia. He was originally Indian ancestry. But this one day he quit. He said, this is the most racist, tormented existence possible. He couldn't take it anymore. At the time, my head of department was under national probation for overt acts of racism. Mm. This man thought apartheid still exists. And even at the hospital that I was, all of the general surgery, subspecialties, every single consultant was white.
Yep.
And that was a black country. Every single consultant was white.
I believe it.
And it was because that individual quit that I got an opportunity along with, and it was a very fierce competition to get that spot. There were dozens of people trying to get that one spot. Some of them were far senior to me. Some of them were actually practicing general surgeons. And it came down to myself and someone who was from Qatar. And this guy was a superstar in his own right. And he had actually rotated with someone who was in urology at the time. And I had rotated with that same person who was in urology at the time. And basically, the guy who was in urology, the head of the department said, you make the choice. These are basically equal candidates. They're both excellent. You can't do any wrong. And I happened to, when I was rotating through trauma, when I was doing general surgery, his son of this guy had some medical issues. And he asked all of us as a group, can you take a call for me on the shortest of notice? And I said, sure, I'll do it. And he wanted to pay me back. And then something happened a couple months later where I had to take two calls from him. And he wanted to pay me back. And I said, no, you deal with your family. So I took three calls, which are living hell, in addition to my normal call. And that stuck with him. And I never asked anything from him. And then it just happened that he remembered that kindness. And he repaid that kindness. And I changed the course of my life. And I think it's changed the course of all the persons that I've touched, even though I'm talking about into the thousands. Yes. So when you think, and then I would have other residents from urology, black, come from other cities in South Africa and say, are you crazy? What are you doing here? This racist institution? do you know? I said, you know what? I come 2 hours earlier than anyone else. I leave at least an hour later than I work harder than anyone else. So for that reason, they see me as the hardest working person in that, and I'm a treasure to be around.
But let's call that out, right?
Yes.
Of course, we know you work hard and you're still working hard even to this day. But I think it's important to call it out for our audience, right? That we talk about opportunity. We talked about, you know, never giving up on yourself. We talk about just being persistent. But we have to really call out putting in the work, right? And, you know, I talked about the process and the outcome. But you really have to put in the work.
And residency training is modern-day slavery. You are abused.
In the healthcare industry, yes. Very much so. We know that that is the case. But let's speak to those who may not even be interested in healthcare, right? Those who are maybe entrepreneurs or folks who may want to go to a trade school or folks who may want to go, you know, in the arts or in the finance business world. The concept is the same. You're going to have to put in the work. Like, you'll have to put in the work. The outcome is not going to just occur by happenstance, right? There's the process, and it has a direct correlation to the outcome. And they're both interdependent. It's not independent of the other. And I think it's a message that I try to really share with everyone, particularly the younger generation, because, you know, we're in an instant society. And so people feel, oh, I should have this many followers on social media. I should be able to do this and that quickly. I should be able to achieve this. I should be able to make this, and whatever it is. But oftentimes folks feel that they can just shortcut the work. It's just not the way it works.
I asked a 16-year-old, what are your dreams? What are your aspirations? What are you looking forward to? What do you want to achieve in the immediate future? And what do you look in the long-term future? And his answer was, I want to own a Rolex watch. And I just say, where is our society going when that is what you want to attain? It doesn't even make practical sense when, unfortunately, we have a crime-ridden society where holding a Rolex watch, particularly for a 16-year-old, is just going to put you a target on your back.
Yeah, but that's everywhere. We have the same stuff up in the U.S. too. So I wouldn't say that that's, you know, so specific to you. I think that's more of a... And I'm no expert in this area, but from what I see with the young folks that I work with in my day-to-day, it's more of what they're exposed to in media at large, right? You know, you talk about local media here, but the world is a smaller place, right? And so local, global, they're all kind of intertwined. And I think oftentimes what we're seeing, particularly as young adults, we're seeing a byproduct of young individuals who are being exposed to topics, aspects of life that they may or may not have the tools to navigate, right? And so when you look at that, yes, the bright, shiny thing, quick and fast, and they're looking at how people are treating the folks that have these things. And so, you know, you have all those factors at play. And, you know, I think, you know, I wouldn't characterize that as something that's just local. I think that's something that's global. But what I will say, what I like about that is that shows you someone who can be motivated, right? It's just in that moment, they're motivated by something that folks like us would say, well, why don't we try to change the motivating factor, right? Maybe have it not be just one watch or not have it be one material item. How about we have it be, you know, education? How about we have it be, you know, employment or a trade or whatever it is, right? And so it's just shifting the lens a little bit because the intent is there. It's just the lens is focused on the wrong items.
And Giselle, so what was the process? What was the transition from Harvard to Yale Law School? And I do remember you also got into Harvard Law School and you chose Yale.
Craig is spending all my business on the streets.
Yeah, he's throwing you out there. He's putting you in the streets.
Well, everybody needs something to aspire to, yes.
Oh, boy.
So, actually, I'd say it was a pretty difficult transition because for those of you who are in college, I was at obviously a liberal arts college, studying a wide variety of things, really enjoying all of it, going to professional school and studying law at a school like Yale, where a lot of people are aspiring to become the next leaders of the United States.
I think the most U.S. presidents came from Yale Law School, correct?
Yeah, and doing that, I'm not sure if it's the most, but certainly quite a few.
Right. That includes the current vice president of the United States, yes.
Yes, Vice President J.D. Vance. So there are the classes felt like that, like people who had studied the history of the United States, who had studied the history of the world, who had studied the U.S. Constitution, and who were very intent and purposeful. And I was young. I'd gone to Harvard at 17. I was 21. I'd grown up outside the country, and it was a big transition. I felt like I was sort of thrown into the fire. I made sort of the best friends in the world while I was there. And I took in a lot. I think I didn't do a ton of talking, but for everything, there's a season. I think I have a lot to say now in the workplace and on behalf of my clients, but that was a time of, I think, listening and learning and understanding and trying to understand what would be my next step in life. And I actually took a step back from the classroom. I don't know if you remember this, and did a research semester and decided to come home to the Bahamas. Yes. And study how laws were developing here in the Bahamas. And that, I think, was necessary for me to combine sort of my upbringing with all of the legal concepts that I was engaged with. So I don't know what the takeaway from that is, but sometimes you have to sort of sit in the moment, sit in the struggle, and, you know, then, you know, sort of like, I guess like a diamond sort of can come out of that process, even if you don't necessarily see what the direction will be.
And I'm sure if you're possibly the only one, you may be one of the only Bahamians ever to become a U.S. district attorney. What was life like as a U.S. district attorney? Yeah. That's a tremendous accomplishment.
So I'm sure I'm not the only sort of Bahamian to do that, but technically the title is Assistant U.S. Attorney, and I was that in the Boston office. And that was, I think, a phenomenal experience representing the government in essentially enforcing the laws. But the reason it was special to me is because it taught me about community and the importance of law and order in the community. I think the term law and order is sometimes used against people to keep people down or to instill fear, but having safety and opportunity and community is empowering. And I guess just to put a story on it, I was an AUSA, so a prosecutor in the Boston office.
Yeah, at sorry, the time of I the, put district. District seems like local. Yes, and throughout the United States, you were assistant U.S. attorney.
But what I was getting to is that I was in that role at the time of the Boston Marathon bombings. And that was an experience, for those of you who are old enough to remember, again, dating myself, that really shook our community in Boston. At the time, Elon and I had a young daughter. There were bomb threats at the courthouse where I worked as a prosecutor. There was a day when everybody in the state had to stay home? Was it the state or the city?
It was basically...
Was it just the Boston area?
It was just eastern Massachusetts. But
okay.
Probably like 80% of the... More like 80% of the population of the state.
It was a shocking terrorist event. And our office, not me personally, but our office took a lead role in prosecuting the Boston Marathon bomber who lived. And I actually went just during my free time to watch those hearings. And the strength of the Boston community really came across through the witnesses who spoke at that trial and my fellow prosecutors who stood up and prosecuted that case and stood up for peace and harmony and against terrorism. It was just a, sort of a very honorable place to be. So I think there was a great gravity to that role, a great responsibility, and I learned about a lot about community and a lot about leadership. And one interesting thing... that we discussed at the office at the time and in the years following was that when there is something as shocking to a community as a terrorist event, people often turn against each other. And they, right, they say, oh, this was committed by this type of person from this religion, right, or this type of politics or this nationality. And we need
to... this ethnicity or this
exactly.
Whatever.
We're going to act out against that. And Boston didn't do that. Boston actually emphasized unity through the theme of Boston Strong.
Yes.
Remember that?
Of course.
Boston Strong became a saying, and it's I think it's actually become an example for other communities on how to react to terror and react to trauma.
Yeah, I think
so,
that was...
I learned a lot about a leadership. Like, as a prosecutor, you have to stand up, right, and argue in court for what you believe in and for freedoms and for who should spend time in jail, and you really have an opportunity to look at your morals and your philosophy, and it was... I think an important phase of growth for me.
A very common topic that's near and dear to me is brain drain. The best and the brightest, maybe 70-80% of our country, go off, do great things in other countries, other cities, and never come home. And that is worrisome for me, for the future of our country, for our children, for my children. Where is our country going to be when I'm sitting with two of the best and the brightest, and you didn't come home. We'll go to my brother, didn't come home, gastroenterologist. Just looking in the medical field alone, we have a cousin who is a professor of urology at Columbia University, never came home. His wife is an internal specialist. We have another cousin who is a pediatric dentist. We have another cousin who is an anesthetist. We have another cousin who's a critical care and pulmonologist. And the list goes on and on. We have another cousin who's a lawyer and a physician. What do you think is the draw for persons not to come home? Or is it a reason that there's a draw to stay in Boston your case, Elon and Giselle? Or is it that there were negatives that you saw in coming back to the Bahamas?
First of all...
And I would also like to qualify that they plan to come back at one point.
Well, when we still do.
Yes.
Right? And so I think that's the first thing I want to say is that for me, and I think for both of us, this isn't a, oh, we're not coming home, right? It's a, we're just not home right now. But this is home, right? Our families are here. This is where we were both raised. Like, there is an intention and a real intention to be here and to contribute on the ground, so to speak. But that doesn't mean we're not contributing in other ways, right? And I think...
But Giselle, you've been off 30 years now, right?
I have. And I'll say, like, obviously this is home, but we've also found home in Boston and community in Boston, yes, too. And I think I just have, you know, maybe this is an easy out for me, but I have a more expansive view of contribution and connection. I feel very connected to the Bahamas, my roots, my family, the community here. And I think we actively look for ways to continue to contribute and invest despite the fact that we do not reside here currently.
Yes, and we do those things with individuals and just trying to, you know, just pour into folks and just do our part.
Yeah.
In many ways, yes.
And I think that that's like when you say you're concerned about brain drain, Greg, I would just encourage you to sort of maybe think more expansively, especially for the moment that we're in with the technology we have, the fact that boundaries between nations are being blurred and that people will live many places probably in their lifetimes if they have the opportunity to do that. And think of it as an opportunity that you have sort of all of this Bahamian talent, not only in the U.S., but
all
over
the
world. The Bahamian diaspora.
That we get to.
And how to channel that and for investment. And I think that for people like you who are home, you have an opportunity to, because sometimes we're looking for ways, right?
Yeah.
And we have friends also who are abroad, and it's sort of like
looking, searching.
Yeah, like
really.
What should we invest in back home? What can we donate to? Who needs help? How can we find the person who we can sort of open the door for in the way that people open doors for us? And so I think instead of like, because there are people who like be like, look at you, you didn't even come home, blah, blah, blah. Like instead of ostracizing that person, maybe channeling like, okay, let's look at you. What opportunities do you have? What doors can you open for other Bahamians? How can you impact the community?
Of course.
Yeah.
And I want to continue on that thought process. And there are two words I want to highlight. One is connection, right? So you can think of this as an increase in expansive and an expanded connection with the Bahamian diaspora, right? The world is a lot more intimate and connected. And so instead of thinking of it as a drain, we should really be working to increase this connection. And then the second word I want to highlight is, you know, Giselle and I both mentioned investment. We're not talking monetarily, and we're not talking monetarily strictly. The exact example she pulled out. There are connections to be made, right? There, where you can connect a Bahamian who is, so to speak, on the ground here in the Bahamas, one of us here, with one of us who is not here, right? And it doesn't have to just be in the U.S. It could be in the U.K. It could be anywhere in this world. But increasing that connectivity and really expanding the Bahamian diaspora such that there are meaningful impacts, not just to groups of individuals, but to our country as a whole, right? And to the Bahamas as a whole. And I think, Giselle, we were talking about it at some point about India taking this approach,
mm-hmm,
right? And just recognizing that a significant portion of their population lives outside of the country, but then being very, strategic about making sure that they had this shift in thinking beyond this brain drain to this, let's increase this connectivity, right, of folks here and folks elsewhere, and how can we utilize this so that this is beneficial for the country and mutually beneficial for all involved. And I think that's happening. I don't think this is a...
people are definitely doing it individually.
Yeah, this is like some unique
even so many
concept
of
for us.
The cousins that you mentioned, Greg, a lot of them are coming back and volunteering and spending time and lecturing and involved in nonprofits and considering coming back. And so I think it's
getting Bahamians into these positions.
Yeah, I think it's fluid. And like any advice and support in sort of establishing the connections that I think are all deep in our hearts would be helpful.
Yeah. But I certainly understand why, if looked at it through that lens, if looked at it through a drain lens, it can be concerning. But I would say our challenge one to look at it through a connection lens, right? And instead of it being a destructive, think of it as a building up aspect.
Well, I mean, if the long-term goal is to come back and you come back internationally known and juggernaut in your own industry, I think that you'd be a force to be reckoned with. And then you'd also look at the fact that you would come back with such power and strength, no one's really going to be able to mess with you.
When you turn me into a superhero? Yeah. The juggernaut? Power and strength, and all these. Like.
Definitely, that's how I see you. But when you come back, you just finished university, you're tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and you have senior persons who want to do nothing but make you miserable and want you to leave the country because of their own ego. I've personally experienced it. I'll tell you, the cartel and the mafia of this world have nothing on some of the senior physicians in the Bahamas.
Well, I pull out from that. I can't speak to that. Yeah. I don't know anything about it, but I will say that.
Do you think if you came home immediately after you finish dental school or orthodontic school that you would have been welcome here and you would have...
Absolutely. 100%. And I mean that. I'm not... First of all, I really go back to what I said earlier, because I truly believe this. Like, there are resources and then there's the source, right? Like, I have this fundamental belief that what is for me the person. Someone could come and stand in front of the door and
well, let me say it. Someone that who's you know well, I won't get into it, and is a specialist and was told essentially by some of the specialists here, don't come back, you're not welcome. So that's the reality. I was called 2 days after I finished by two people threatening me, don't come home.
I'll give you another example. So I live in Boston, right?
Yes.
We both live there. There are three dental schools all within a mile of each other. There are folks who have reached out to me and told me that they've experienced something similar, mm-hmm. right? So what you're describing is real, but I don't think it's isolated to one particular community. Right. And so I'm not trying to discredit what you're saying. I just can't speak to that. But I also don't want to take a narrow or a, I shouldn't say narrow, but I don't want to take a limited view of who that's happening to, when that's happening, why that's happening, because I see it happening even in the communities where we are, where we're at, where people think it's so much better. And I can tell you it's not. Like, people will say stuff like, you know, someone said to me the other day, I was somewhere and I was waiting, and they said, oh, I bet you don't wait in line like this. I'm like, yes, I do. Like, just as much. You can go into some of the, you know, local agencies within the city of Boston, and yes, you will sit and wait. Very much.
So well, this hour has gone very quickly, and you know? It's been inspirational.
That's it?
You'll have to come on again when you're back in Nassau. But any closing remarks, Giselle, or any words of inspiration to young persons who want to follow your path?
Yeah, just thank you so much for having me, Greg. This has been a pleasure. If you're out there, follow your dreams, dream big, think expansively, and, you know, the world is yours.
And Elon?
Thank you for having us, and thank you for having me and allowing us to spend this time with you. It's been fun. But I'm going to piggyback onto Giselle and have a minor addition. Dream big, yes, but work hard. Like, work really hard.
And I would just like to say these are two shining examples of Bahamians doing great things. Not everything is doom and gloom. The future is bright, and they will back to our Bahama land. I will ensure that happens and make it a better and brighter place. And I'm proud of both of you. And I just like to say as a side note, we're the three brothers. You, my brother Jonathan, we're all in the medical field, and we all married lawyers. So I don't know if there's something to that. We're all like-minded.
I like to say I was first. So
yes, I think
I can think of myself as a trailblazer.
I guess we were following you. All right. So have a good night. Dream big, Bahamas young persons. Shoot for the stars. Even if you fall short, you'll still be in the clouds. Have a good and safe week, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Dr. Gregory Pinto and my sister, who is Harvard, Yale trained equity partner in the top 25 Boston law firm in the United States. My brother-in-law, Dr. Elon Jaffer, who is a Tufts University, top dental school in the world, Harvard.
Not in the world.
In the United States, sorry.
To me, it's the top.
Okay, Harvard lecturing dental orthodontist.
Oh,
we're proud of you, and the Bahamas is proud of you. Have a good night.
All right. Take care.
Don't give up on hope.
Don't be ashamed. It's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.
You will find
he'll help you solve your problems on 96.9.